Before I begin, I'd like to apologize that in the remaining half hour that I have to speak, I will not be able to take questions because time doesn't allow, but there is an open session at 12 o'clock, so please write your questions down, and at that time I will be able to handle the questions that you are asking. As you have heard, my role this morning is not to engage in the social or the political or even the practical dimensions of the prenuptial agreement, but rather to focus more on the halakhic issues which revolve it. Any time something which has not been used yesterday is used today, it causes a stir in the halakhic world, and so it should be. We don't believe in having anything slip by us without a careful analysis. And this prenuptial agreement is no exception. It was subjected to rigorous halakhic analysis as well as legal analysis, and this is an opportunity to thank all those members of the legal community who toiled over years to formulate this agreement, to improve the agreement, to make sure that it would in fact be enforceable in secular jurisdictions as well. The beginnings of this formulation go back nearly 20 years when our yeshiva, he was learning Masechet Gittin, and because of a particular aguna case in my own community, I decided with my talmidim to get more involved in trying to do something to on a systemic basis instead of just a case-by-case basis to help alleviate this problem. And I came across something which had been printed 2 years before, in 1988, in a journal called Moriah, which appears in Yerushalayim. It was an article written by someone with whom I've been dealing since that very time, the last 20 years in this matter. His name is Rabbi Tzvi Gartner, a major Talmud Chacham who lives in Jerusalem. And he quoted a very, very notable Torah scholar, an esteemed rabbinical judge and teacher, Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who advocated a type of prenuptial agreement which he felt would significantly limit aguna cases. I began a correspondence, first on the phone and then in writing, with Rabbi Goldberg Shalita to try to find ways to use his agreement in a practical way, which hadn't been done for the few years that had lapsed. After going back and forth between him and a number of other great Rabbanim, a particular formulation emerged. It took a while, and there was a consensus going back to 1992, that is now 18 years ago, that emerged to actually endorse a particular agreement. I have to give you a second apology, that somehow in the reproduction of the disagreement, which is in front of you on the middle page, half was cut off. But that, these things happen. It's just an original Hebrew-typed, somewhat primitive, version of the text. And again, the first half of each line is cut off. What is important is to see the signatures. The first and most prominent of Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who's assigned his name as the, in effect, the one who had encouraged it from the beginning. Underneath him is the signature of Rav Tzimba List, a very noted dayan in Tel Aviv. And as a matter of fact, the formulation as we have it today really came from him. And Rav Goldberg agreed to that version. Top right, you'll see with the date Shvat Tovshin and Beis, Maskim Latzah Na Ovadia Yosef, and is clearly detectable handwriting. Those are the three rabbis, three great Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. On the bottom left, you'll see that Rabbi Libis of blessed memory signed, who was a great rabbi first here in the Bronx and later in Borough Park. And what's missing completely on the bottom right, you see a few little lines, is the signature of our own Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who was our own Rosh Bezdin. These are the five individuals, and again, the Hebrew type is not complete, missing the beginning of each line, but it basically says that a person attempts upon himself to support his wife, and if Chas V'Shalom is the end of the second line, that we are not able to live together in one dwelling, Me'ezetan Shehiyah, it's a very important line, for whatever reason, I obligate myself a certain dollar sum, X, as long as we are married, because that's Moshe V'Yisrael, and we emphasize that this obligation exists even if the woman has a different source of income. Moreover, the man forgives any obligation that the woman has towards him during that period of time. That's important because otherwise, if the woman makes a significant income, the man can say, of course I'll give you this amount of money, but you have to give me back your income, which may be equal or more. And then it says, this is very, very important, that if I will azmin osal din Torah, if I will invite her, summon her to a din Torah about this, in a bezin kavua, and she will not observe what the bezin says, lo tzoras dina, either because she will not appear, or because she will not obey, and I will be willing to obey the psak of the bezin, then this obligation will stop. Yipasek chiyuv yizeh. And then the last line is a way in order to see to it that the obligation is in fact effective. Kinyan gomor bebezin chashuv me'achshav. That's a little bit blocked out. And there's a date, etc., etc. This is the long and the short of it in its original primitive form, which again was typed up in Yerushalayim and Shvat of 1992, and was the basis of subsequent English language formulations, which led ultimately to what we have in front of us, which has been given out as the Beth Din of America binding arbitration agreement. It's not the time to go into the every last nuance of the legalisms as to why it's called a binding arbitration agreement and not a prenuptial agreement. As a matter of fact, there used to be initially two separate agreements, an arbitration agreement and a prenuptial agreement, and they were combined into one. If you just look on page one, it's very important just to go through it briefly to get a general idea of what it's about. The first lines are filled in each and every case, giving the date and the place and the names. And as we heard earlier, the first part is simply an arbitration agreement to appear before the Bezin of America. And we have jurisdiction, in any case, over the get, ksuba, tenoim, this agreement itself. At the bottom of page one is something which is quite remarkable and important. There are different strokes for different folks. People, we just read yesterday in the Torah HaKadosha, Ve'el HaMishpotem Asher Tosin Lefneihem, and Rashi comments immediately, Lefneihem V'lo Lefnei Elilim, that we are supposed to adjudicate all of our differences, whether they be monetary in nature or marital in nature, in front of a proper Bezdin. Given that fact, there is, in some cases, a reluctance to do so. Rabbi Reese wrote about it in the sheet that was handed out to you earlier. And we do not want the prenup to be dependent upon these attitudes. So therefore, there are different options as to how much jurisdiction the Bezin will in fact have. That's what's called Roman numeral 4. Roman numeral 4, A, 1, 2, and 3 are to introduce additional jurisdiction to the Bezin, not only to be able to decide on the earlier matters of get, disagreement, ksuba, and tenoim, but also on additional monetary matters, which can include division of property and maintenance. And 1, 2, and 3 can be either as a simple way, one as a bezin would normally do, based upon the Shulchan Aruch, and other particular case-specific considerations. But 2 and 3 provide that the bezin should base themselves on principles of either equitable distribution or community property law, These are two types of laws which exist in particular states of the Union. We made reference here to the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, which is not a state, to my knowledge, not a law in any particular state. This is for halachic reasons, to make it even further removed from actual secular law, but these concepts are quite clear. For those who are uninitiated, equal distribution means that the court of law will try to find something which is equitable, which is fair to them, a fair way to distribute property based on a whole series of considerations. And community property basically is a 50-50 split of the property. Generally, courts of law adopt this more or less a no-fault type of an approach. They don't go into whose fault the breakup of the marriage was, as they used to. Saves them a lot of time in secular court, and this is what this provision calls for. Now, number 4B, perhaps the most sensitive, includes child custody, support, and visitation matters. A full disclosure. A secular court, by its own rules, is not bound by this 4B, because they consider themselves to be in charge of the children of a divorcing couple. Notwithstanding that fact, whenever our Beis Din has decided matters of custody, visitation, and support, it has been upheld in secular court. And the reason, one reason is Siyata Dishmai, that's for sure. But an additional reason is that we, as a rule, have a standard similar to that of the secular court, which is what's in the best interest of the children. And we try our best to, in fact, have professionals who are, from our perspective, the best to decide these things, whether they be psychologists, whether they be other experts that we consult that are just as qualified, perhaps even more qualified, than the experts that the court consults. So they're unlikely to just turn it around and start the thing all over again when, after they look at it, you know, they're also overburdened with their case docket. And they see that they did a good job. And we recognize this man. He's a well-known professional in the field of mental health and of child psychology, etc. So we've been successful in having our agreements upheld, even on 4B. But once again, the core of the agreement will not be dependent upon whether these things are signed. We advise to sign it. We don't insist on it. But even if it's not signed, the remainder of the agreement is valid. Turn the page to page 2. Four C on top says the Beis Din of a marriage may consider the respective responsibilities either of both parties at the end of the marriage as an additional but not exclusive factor in determining the distribution of marital property and maintenance. In other words, whereas the secular court has adopted a sort of no-fault policy, our Beis Din, since we are duty-bound to follow whenever possible the laws of the Torah, is not going to be oblivious to such considerations, and that's why it's put in here, because otherwise our hands would be tied by the type of secular laws to which we referred on the previous page. Okay, the rest is, generally speaking, boilerplate, until we get to the italicized part. This is the assumption of obligation. Let's read it carefully together. Are hereby now, this is in Roman numeral 7, me'aksha, that is a technical term. The technical term me'aksha is utilized to overcome a problem which is known as asmachta, which we'll come to in a few moments. Obligate myself to support my wife to be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reasons, at the rate of $150 per day, skipping the parentheses about the adjustments, in lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings, as we mentioned before. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum. And we had a little bit of a problem in purely halachic terminology, whether this can be done before the marriage. So this is why this next sentence was inserted. And I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. This is a topic for a different discussion, how this works in Jewish law, but it does. I acknowledge that I have now, me'akshav, again, effected the above obligation by means of a kinyan, formal Jewish transaction, in an esteemed chashuv Beis Din, as prescribed by Jewish law. A kinyan, a achshav, and a bezin chashuv overcomes the problem which we have not discussed fully of asmachta, and that is why this is there. As a matter of information, one need not actually do it. You don't have to find the bezin chashuv, you don't have to do a kinyan. Once you admit to it, we have an additional legal principle called Hodas Baal Din Tumea Edom Dami. If I admit to something, if there are 100 witnesses testifying to it, for the mere fact that it's signed, suffices. Now we come back to non-italicized print, very important again. However, this support obligation shall terminate if wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice before the Bezdin of America, or in the event that the wife-to-be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the Bezdin of America. Need not even be a decision, even a recommendation. This is, we saw, is found originally, in the original Hebrew language document, more or less. And this is the new sense which was put in recently. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of the support obligation attributable to the period preceding her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to husband-to-be that she intends to collect the above sum. Said written notification must include wife-to-be's notarized signature. This is put in for the following reason. We had a case in which a woman was involved in a get situation with a husband. The husband was above board, never withheld the get for one moment. It just took a while till they got through all the legalisms, and it was not his fault any more than it was hers. It just took a while. You know, some of these things do take a while. They wanted to have the civil divorce done first, that they both wanted, whatever the case may be. It took about a significant amount of time that happened. And after everything was done, and the man never said for one second that he's going to hold his wife in Nagula, not for a single second. He's completely above board. Then he got a bill for, I think, $100,000. Retroactively, they want the money. After all, you agreed to give me that much of money per day. We were separated X number of time ago. Here's the math. Case came before our Bezdin. Won't go into the details of the case, but we felt that to clear up this kind of a misunderstanding and this kind of a possibility, it should be written explicitly. This is not something which you can wake up years later and say, I want the money retroactive. If you want it, just say you want it. The husband's put on notice. This may cause the husband to come more quickly to a bed and say, listen, man, if you want this ticker to keep going, then I want the get to be done right now, and I'm not going to wait until the time that you want to wait, or you have to figure out some way of a legal device to exempt me from this ongoing obligation, as the case may be. This is the long and short of the agreement. The next page includes the signatures, includes witnesses, and includes acknowledgments. And thanks to one of our good lawyer friends, at the bottom of page 3, says in New York State, the officiating rabbi is qualified to notarize a prenuptial agreement, and he used the following form. So if I do a wedding in New York State, I'm able to notarize it myself. This solves the intricacies of going to a notary public, which can be sometimes burdensome. Truth to tell, it's not completely clear in law whether this notarization is even necessary. But we have lawyers who, as the expression goes, would like to adorn a belt and suspenders. So for this reason, this is something which should be done. Page 4, which is the opposite page, is simply an instruction sheet, which explains some of the points that we brought out, and it's certainly worth reading. I'd like to just, before I go into a brief discussion of Asmachta, tell you what else is in front of you. Two things. One, they both come from two winters ago, when I was in Eretz Yisrael, it was decided, you know, it's already, at that point, 16 years since anyone had actually signed the original agreement in Eretz Yisrael, and we had made certain improvements. We went back to Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg and tried to give him an updated version, so there should be no misunderstanding as to what we're actually doing in the real world, so that he should fix his signature once again. And what you have in front of you on the outside page, which starts with the word Bemida and ends with Rav Zalman Nechemi's signature, is more or less a translation of the basics of the prenup as I just read it to you, with his signature on the bottom. I got a little scroll of my own handwriting that he thought might be appropriate to add. And you see, those who can read Hebrew well can understand that this is more or less summarizes the actual meat of the agreement that we had just described. On the back pages, at that same time, we went to a rising star in the halachic world, whom we hadn't even known about way back in 1992, named Rabbi Usher Weiss, who has significant dealings with the American community. And I approached him together with my friend Rabbi Gartner. You can see that the letters written to both of us. And he wrote a significant piece about it. Some of the things are really extraneous to our present discussion. It's based on something which I had written in a different context. But I think what's most important is the last line, the last paragraph, which you'll see right before his signature. The etzem takana zudava godalu. He thinks that this is a great matter, a great thing to do. In those cases, that mikrim in cases shalulei shtarzeh, but not for this document, what would happen? Talich ha-period va-gerushin nimshach ar-ein kates, interminably. Toch machlokes v'sinas chinam v'agmas nefesh she'ein lo shir. Wow. That describes some unfortunate reality that we see. Translated literally, with disputes and baseless hatred and aggravation, which is unlimited. Now, obviously we want to try to stop that. But hodos, the mismach zeh, because of this document, his garshu tovs man kosher mitoch haskama v'kavod zeh lezeh. Not only with an abbreviated situation, but it's also with agreement and honor one for another. What a wonderful result. Again, not for now, this prenup is not ironclad. There are cases when it won't matter. If the person is very wealthy, we'll just pay the money, he doesn't care about his wife. If he's very poor, say, you can't touch me, I'm judgment proof, I have no money to give you. But for most cases, it's very effective. This leaves me about 7 minutes to go into a halach discussion of asmachta. Obviously, we can't do that in 7 minutes, but just to give you an idea. One of my arguments in trying to prove that there's no asmachta issue is a citation which is found 4 paragraphs up, Vera'isi, Rabbi Weiss quotes it, from Nachlas Shiva. Nachlas Shiva is a student of the Taz, going back to the 17th century, and he quotes a Takona Shum Shpira Vermeiza Vagensa. These are very early communities which thrived in the 12th century, and this is what it says, quote, V'yimchatz v'shalom, if there'll be breaking up of the parties, he'll give her 10 gold coins. As long as the ktat, the altercation, persists, he'll give her this amount of money. This is of great significance because this agreement is in fact cited in the Beis Shmuel, the Pische Tshuva, and the standard Evan Ezra. You can look it up. Again, not the time to go into those details right now. So I felt this is an ample precedent for our prenuptial, which number one would obviate the issue, what they call today Chodesh Asur Min HaTorah. It can't do anything new. It's not new. It's old. And number two demonstrates that it's not an asmachta problem, because if it's not a problem for them, it's not a problem for us. So Rabbi Weiss is not so clear that this is in fact true. In the next paragraph, he thinks that this particular takana was engendered by a concern. It was only done so she shouldn't starve to death. It was not meant so that to encourage the husband to divorce his wife, so he should not have to continue to pay her the daily, weekly, or monthly obligation as set forth in the document. But this is a matter of historical question. They didn't have legislative jackets in Shum or in Poland or where the Nachlat Shiva lived. So it's anybody's guess, unless someone wants to do a PhD thesis to find out what exactly was the intention of the original formulators. I don't know. What I do think is that even if Rabbi Weiss is correct, it demonstrates that there was not an asmachta problem. Full disclosure, I believe in full disclosure, I now move down to 5 minutes. There are those who have qualms about this, and they say maybe there really is an asmachta, like anything in Jewish law. What in Jewish law has no dispute? Is there anything? So there are those who think that maybe there is an asmachta problem. And when faced with this clear-cut proof to the contrary of Takanas Shum, they counter, well, Takanas Shum In those days, the Bezdin had more power, and they could, in fact, enforce their ideas to the principle of Hefker, Bezdin, Hefker, which means that they could do whatever they want, and therefore they were immune from any asmachta objection, as opposed to what they did nowadays. One can make a case for that. If one looks again on the side of that same Siman in Shulchan Aruch, in Evan Ezer, you have to look at Siman Nun and Siman Nun Beis, those are the two Simanim, you will see that there was indeed a difference between Germany and Poland. That in Poland, the Takana Shum was automatic, whether you signed it or not, it was binding. And certainly in that kind of a case, this objection has some merit. However, in Germany, it was not. It was not an automatic. You had to sign it. And it seems to me that if you had to sign it, it was not based on a Hefker, Bezdin, Hefker analysis, and therefore would be an ample precedent for our prenuptial agreement. The truth is that when this agreement was originally formulated, I was asked to go to Rabbi Elyashiv Shalita to ask him about it. It was not really my idea, because it's hard to get a full audience over there. And as a matter of fact, he listened to me very politely and sent me to one of his aides to have a hearing about it. A very, very honest and very talented and bright American individual. We had a conversation. And he explained some of the objections. The only objection that Rabbi Elyashiv ever expressed in writing, at least in writing to a surrogate, to Rabbi Gartner, was the fear that in fact the person who signed the document would not know what he signed. Now that is a significant fear. Rabbi Gartner in his article countered that that may be an Eretz Yisrael. It's just, but in America, when things go through lawyers, you better believe they understand it. I've had cases where they go back and forth over weeks with lawyers to assist and that, sign this way, sign that way, they object to this clause and that, but you know, that's what lawyers do. And since the people are given an opportunity, and it's even mentioned in the document itself, to have legal counsel, presumably it is being understood by the people who are signing it. Frankly, if you look in Shulchan Aruch and Evan Ezer, this is in Siman Samavav, at the end it says, even if a person does not understand what he is signing, if he's given time to look at it, then it's binding anyway. So I'm not exactly sure what the objection is, although I would say that it's important that we try to have this form filled out early on, not at the wedding. At the wedding, the person will say, well, you signed it, I thought it was part of the wedding, and it could be some kind of an objection. Again, I don't think it would hold up anyway, but there'd be some kind of a mini objection on those grounds, so it's an additional reason to have it signed in advance, if it's at all possible. Rav Elyashiv did not object to me or in writing or to discussing with Rabbi Gartner's case, was asmachta. But in a tshuva, which has been printed since then, in his Kovitz tshuvas, Rav Elyashiv is a person who is concerned about asmachta, even if this all the precautions that were taken, which means one more time, let's discuss all three of the precautions. It's a kinyan, me'achshav, bebezdin choshev. Despite that fact, he has certain objections, and this time doesn't allow, I only have a minute or two to go, just to give you a source sheet for those who want to look it up, it's in the Sefer Kovitz Tshuvas, this is the first volume, I believe, Choshen Mishpat Simen Kuf Samach Gimel, where he discusses this issue of Asmachta, and he claims, he quotes a Maharit to buttress his claim, that perhaps if it's a case of what we call a hischaivus, an obligation, as opposed to a hakna, an acquisition, that perhaps even with all these three precautions in place, there may be an issue of Asmachta. Far be it for me to argue with such a halachic giant. I do believe the Maharit, in fact, does bear him out. My counter-argument is simply that, yes, a single opinion can be found about almost any matter. I'll go beyond Rabbi Elyashiv. I'm willing to concede, perhaps even the Rambam is of this opinion. But I count the Tov Kedei Dibur that it doesn't matter, because the Shulchan Aruch does not hold that way, Rabbi Yosef Karo. The Ramah does not hold that way, Rabbi Moshe Israels. And these are the two giants whose laws we follow on a practical basis day by day. And for this reason, I believe that the Asmachta issue is not an issue. I have to tell you that when the original agreement was formulated, and I went to some of my friends in Brooklyn, among the rabbis there. So I had conversations with two of them. They share the last name. It's Cohen, Rabbi David Cohen and Rabbi Feivel Cohen. They did not object on legal grounds whatsoever. Rabbi Feivel Cohen even has a book, a sefer, in a different context of Yerusha called Midor L'Dor, in which he assumes that such a formulation will overcome the problem of Asmakta. And why it's not being done in Brooklyn, more generally, is not my topic. It will come back at 12 o'clock. When I answer questions, I'll try to get to that. But I just have one more source, just by a quirk, in the exact same number tshuva, Kuf Samach Gimel, I believe it's in the second volume of Rabbi Yashiv's tshuvas, Kovitz tshuvas, he happens to have a counter-argument over and above what I said, which is, this is, I'll leave you with a tantalizing thought. My students asked me this so many years back, I just don't know what to answer them. Why isn't every ksuba an asmachta? Every single ksuba, not the part that's mandated, the part that is added, what we call tosefis, means that a person says that in case the marriage will terminate, then I'll pay you X. That sounds like it's exactly a textbook case of asmachta. I was bothered by the question. So that's where Rabbi Yashiv quotes that a sefer called the Erech Shai asks the question. And answer something remarkable. That anything which is done in the steps leading up to the marriage is subject to a very important principle. The principle is, Omde v'kikshu, heim heim advar v'nikne v'amira, a Talmudic statement which Rav Gittel says in Masechta Kiddushin. And he says, this overcomes asmachta. That being the case, it would seem to overcome asmachta in the case of a prenup as well. And perhaps for this reason, the Rabbi Yashiv himself never really formulated an objection to our prenup based upon asmachta, despite his earlier held opinion. Perhaps this is the reason. Could be many. I'm just speculating, just to give you some kind of halachic meat and potatoes to think about. My time is up. Again, I apologize in advance not to be able to take questions at this time. At 12 o'clock, I'll be happy to take as many questions as you have. Thank you for listening.